I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good evening. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University joins me. The drama is higher than ever in Ukraine crisis. Convoy, a massive convoy of Russian trucks, white, rolling south from Moscow, a 3 kilometer long convoy. Between 198 and 280 trucks, the reporting varies, filled with what we're told is 2,000 metric tons of food and medicines and water, 62 tons of baby food, 54 tons of medical equipment, 12,000 sleeping bags, 69 generators, tons of cereals and sugars, all for the Donbass, the region of Ukraine, now under attack by the National Guard of Kiev, volunteers, not mercenaries, they say, volunteers. And we'll speak of who that National Guard is in a moment. But this convoy is the present story. The news is not just on Russian media. It is also on European media. You can go to the Reuters site now and watch a video for a minute and a half of this massive convoy. Steve, a very good evening to you. Russia's sending humanitarian relief to Ukraine. The drama is not in the significance and the generosity of the emergencies ministry. That's what's dispatching this from Russia. It's what happens at the border. Kiev now looks to reject this convoy. What is the drama for Kiev? Why won't they accept the food? Good evening to you, Steve.
Well, I think, first of all, they don't want, Kiev, to acknowledge that there is a real humanitarian catastrophe in the cities that they, Kiev, have been bombarding for weeks. Now, your listeners may not have a visual image of it. Your listeners probably have seen on television visual images, and this is not an editorial on whether Israel's right or wrong, but of the damage done in Gaza, in the urban areas of Gaza. I mean, cities are dense, intricate social environments of schools and hospitals and parks and playgrounds and infrastructure, and bombs and artillery do tremendous amount of damage. And we can imagine, because we've seen it, what's happened in Gaza, whether we approve of it or not. But we aren't shown, for some reason, on American television, what's been happening in the two large cities of what the Russians and Ukrainians call the Donbass. And that's the biggest city, Donetsk, with about slightly over 1 million people. It did have the city, I'm told, and I believe Anna Nemtsova, who talked to you on occasion and was there, has said it's almost deserted, like a ghost city.
Yes, a ghost city is how she describes it. Yes.
So what's happened there is what we can imagine. We've seen it happen in history and in recent histories when cities are bombed. And the city has lost its water supply. It's lost its essential food. It's lost its medicine. Its hospitals are damaged. Its communications are destroyed. According to the best sources, there are nearly 1 million refugees. About 750,000 have fled to Russia because it's just a few kilometers away across the border into Rostov province. But about another 150,000 have fled someplace in Ukraine where there's no fighting. So you got, let's say, roughly 1 million refugees. The number of people dead and wounded is in the thousands. The numbers range from a few thousand to 10. We don't know, but way too many. As always, in these circumstances, the first victims are the elderly and the children. And since you can't separate the mothers from the children, women. So it is a real humanitarian catastrophe that Kiev doesn't want to own up to, because if it admitted it, it would declare a ceasefire and stop. Also, it doesn't want the West, Kiev doesn't, to have any political diplomatic relations with the self-styled republics of these two cities. You remember a few months ago, they had referenda, and in big turnouts, great majorities voted that they would be not separate, but they would be home rule governments. Kiev doesn't want that acknowledged, so any international force that attempts a humanitarian relief mission is de facto acknowledging the existence of these political authorities. But here's the other thing. Everybody is guessing what Russian President Putin is going to do. Now, the reason it's dramatic is the Donbass is almost as close historically, ethnically, economically, politically, culturally, to Russia as was Crimea, which Putin annexed back in March. But remember that the Donbass is not only, Donetsk, for example, was not only a beautiful European city, but it's the site of Ukraine's essential industrial complex, mining, manufacturing, military industry. Who's going to build this infrastructure that's being destroyed? So Putin, we've talked about it before, but let's remind ourselves, because it's part of the political story unfolding, is under tremendous, and I follow the Russian media, tremendous pressure at top, that is in the political elite, and among ordinary people, to do something to save what Russians call our compatriots in Donbass. Because, overwhelmingly, the population, though they're not all, by any means, ethnic Russians, they are native-speaking Russians. They are part of Russia culturally. What is Putin going to do? When is he going to do something? And he hasn't done much. He just keeps calling for a ceasefire. So the question arises whether this humanitarian mission, almost 200 trucks, I believe, John.
More than 200 trucks.
Trucks.
Yes.
Ambling, moseying, lumbering from Russia toward the checkpoints around Kharkiv and Kiev, scheduled to arrive either tomorrow or early the next day.
620 miles, and we don't know the speed of the convoy,
right,
but it's spectacular.
But they're on their way. So if you look at the website, the Russian websites, what you see is completely conflicting reports. One says the Red Cross has signed off on this and is a co-sponsor with Russia. Another says Kiev has accepted it. But you've got just as many reports saying Kiev is warning it better not approach the checkpoints because it thinks it's a kind of military mission. And the Red Cross kind of making different statements. Now, remember that the International Red Cross, unlike the United Nations, when it has a humanitarian mission, does not send armed guards to protect the humanitarians. The problem is this is a war zone. Remember the Malaysian jetliner that they couldn't get to. It's like that. So there is some anxiety that this is not only humanitarian, and I think, in fact, they're compatible. If I have one more minute to wrap this
sure.
up. Here, I think this is what Putin and the men around him are thinking. Yes, we may have to intervene militarily, though I continue to think it won't be primarily a land operation. It'll be air power, but we can discuss that separately. But we want to see if the people who call themselves the self-defenders, that is the rebel armies, there's about 15,000 of them, defending the cities, can defend the cities, and we want to see if Kiev would really be foolish enough to enter the cities at the moment they're on the outskirts. Because you know, John, when you send men and you send tanks into a city, they become captive of the environment of that city. Streets that are not impassable, barricades, snipers in the buildings, hand grenades, landmines. It's exceedingly dangerous to see what Kiev is really prepared to do. So humanitarian, absolutely, lots of baby food. But at the same time, they need to give nutrition to the fighters. I mean, the fighters have to eat and drink, too. So that probably is real. And what Putin's calculation is, we'll do this, it's the right thing to do, we won't use our forces, and we will see if either it produces a ceasefire, in which case some people can begin negotiations, then we've accomplished our diplomatic mission, or if not, if it reinforces the self-defenders sufficiently that they can defend the cities and drive back the Ukrainian forces, we don't have to intervene, and the last end game, of course, would be actual Russian troops in Ukraine, though I think primarily in the air and not on the ground.
I'm speaking with Stephen F. Cohen. His book is most recent book to this crisis is Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War. When Steve published this, the New Cold War was a theory that he was advancing. Now it's in place. We'll discuss the confrontation between Moscow and Washington. I note, when we come back, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Sydney in these last hours, making statements about, quote, our hope is that in the next days and weeks we can find a way for President Poroshenko and Ukraine to be able to work with the Russians to provide the humanitarian assistance. However, the foreign minister of Australia, as well as the foreign minister of Paris, also in Australia with Secretary Kerry, are both warning that this convoy could contain military gear, as Fabius of Paris says, we must be extremely careful because this convoy could be a cover for Russians to install themselves near Lugansk and Donetsk and put us before a done deed. The doubts of Ukraine crisis. When we come back, I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University. Russian history is here with me. The doubts about the convoy are extant in Australia, where foreign ministers meeting are pointing to this convoy as disguise, as much the same way Kiev does. It says it won't let this convoy in because it contains military gear. No proof is given. I mentioned, Steve, that this convoy left Moscow with spectacular staging. A Russian Orthodox priest went down the line of trucks sprinkling holy water on it. In addition, the Russian media is covering the three-kilometer-long convoy of containers and trucks very carefully as it rolls south towards the entrance at Kharkiv. We don't know what's going to happen to this. We can say right now, Steve, there are doubts in Europe about the present course. What I think they're worrying about is, what is Kiev's exit strategy, Steve? What does Kiev believe, that all of a sudden 15,000, 5,000, a million people are going to come out and bow down to Kiev? Is that the end of the war from Poroshenko's point of view?
I mean, I think that rational policymakers in Europe, particularly in France and especially in Germany, realize that they've created a monster in Kiev they cannot control, that only Washington can control the Poroshenko government. They are asking themselves, because remember, France, Germany, and Russia, whatever their disagreements, have for weeks called on Poroshenko to declare a ceasefire. And then they, presumably led by the Germans, would broker talks. And they may take 2 days, they may take 2 months, but the killing would stop. And they would be political talks about the future of Ukraine. Kiev is refused. So we have to ask, though we don't know the answer, since Kiev can't exist politically or militarily or economically without Washington, why has the White House not just picked up the phone and told Poroshenko, we want a ceasefire beginning tomorrow morning at 8 a.m.? And the only answer that I can come up with, and it's theoretical, hypothetical, is twofold. Either they do want Putin to intervene because they think it's showdown time with the hated Putin, or they think that Poroshenko, they believe Kiev's propaganda that it's on the march, it's irresistible, it's going to take the cities, that if Poroshenko takes the cities in the Donbass, then the whole of Ukraine now belongs to the European Union. And not to be too crude, the European Union belongs to Washington, and all of Ukraine will be taken out of the Russian sphere of influence, economic, political, and military, and brought into the West. And therefore, as some neocon conservatives in Washington have written in the newspapers, the Great March East since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 will have ended triumphantly with the taking of Ukraine. The problem with this madness is that that's what the Kremlin also thinks the goal, Washington's goal is. That's why we could be on the verge of war. That's the problem, because everyone knows what the terms of negotiation are. They've been out there and discussed since this crisis began in February. They've been documents. But they've all been thrown aside for the fury and fog of war. And if there was ever an armed conflict that was easy, given the will, to resolve politically, it's this one. This isn't like Israel and Palestine. This isn't God's mischief that's gone on for centuries. This has a political solution. All it takes is two or three leaders and some people of goodwill, and it would be over. It will be difficult, but the killing will end. So this is a slow, unfolding, murderous tragedy in the heart of Europe, for gosh sakes. We are talking about Ukraine is in Europe. Part Western Russia is in Europe. This is a war in Europe. And yet, in the United States, it gets less attention. May he rest in peace. than Robin Williams. It's astonishing. It's almost like we can't take anymore.
The formula, Steve, that you've just laid out is that Poroshenko does not have an exit other than total victory. Or as one of his fighters said the other day, they want to see a white flag, which is so unrealistic. It suggests that Kiev is just about murder and it wants Russia to intervene. In other words, Steve, the point of the depredations visited on Luhansk and Donetsk is to force the Russian military to cross the border. That triggers the conflict that Kiev believes is its only way out. Kiev doesn't have a peaceful solution. It only has war.
If you're right, and one of the questions we haven't discussed is we don't know to what extent Poroshenko is his own man. He's president of Ukraine or part of Ukraine. The extent to which he's his own man or somebody is operating him, we don't know that. But if we ask the question, might they want to provoke the Russians, then they have in mind, of course, the scenario that unfolded in Georgia, former Soviet Georgia, in 2008, when the president of Georgia, Saakashvili, who's an advisor to Poroshenko now, though he lives in the United States, willfully killed Russian peacekeepers on the Georgian-Russian border, attacked a Russian enclave city, like the Donbass, inside Georgia, knowing it would bring the Russians across the border, but thinking that the United States and NATO were going to come to his attention. In other words, his way out, Saakashvili, was to compel the United States and NATO to go to war with Russia. This is what we call the tail wagging the dog. But to make matters worse, we create these tails. Now, whether we've lost control of Poroshenko or whether he's doing what the White House wants, I don't know. And I can't ask Obama. He's playing golf. Kerry's someplace gone away. But clearly, it would take one phone call from the White House or from Martha's Vineyard, if that's where Obama is, to Poroshenko to end this tomorrow morning. It's not defeat. It's not surrender. It's just saying you need to talk.
And that's what the ceasefire would do, Steve. A ceasefire would bring negotiations from Europe, and they would never start the shooting again. And
I don't know they'd never start again, but you're right about one thing. There can be no negotiations while the fighting's going on, because, as you said, Poroshenko is demanding that the rebels disarm and surrender,
right.
And then he's going to talk to somebody who lives in that region, but not to them. Those are the terms of surrender, not the terms of negotiation. But, John, that's been going on for weeks and months now, and meanwhile, not to make this a soap opera, but thousands of people are dying.
Steve Cohen has a new piece up at The Nation, and when we come back, we will discuss it, because it's worth investigating who is in the National Guard that is shelling and rocketing and mortaring a large European city, Luhansk, so that it's deserted. Who's doing this fighting? I'm John Batchelor with Steve Cohen. This is the John Batchelor Show. Steve Neff Cohen is here with me, and we continue our conversation about Ukraine crisis, which Steve correctly says does not get nearly enough attention in the American media, given all the crises in the world. Northern Iraq and Gaza, of course, the Syrian civil war, and the conflict zones across North Africa all receiving their attention. We have Ebola crisis in West Africa. Yes, we know we're overwhelmed with bad news, but Ukraine crisis is about two nuclear superpowers banging against each other in diplomatic circles right now. But were there to be a dark moment in contemplation in Moscow at the same time in Washington, we could see military confrontation between NATO and Russia. So let's ask, who is in the National Guard of Kiev that is seeking to trigger, or at least certainly nakedly provoking, Vladimir Putin and the Russian people? Who is mortaring civilians? There is reporting in the New York Times, and there's reporting in Europe, of part of the National Guard, the Azov Battalion. Steve, you and I have corresponded about the Azov Battalion, and I've sent you what I can discover. It is boldly announcing that it has attracted foreign nationals. Some of those foreign nationals are keen to emphasize they come from parties in Western Europe that are called neo-Nazi parties. This goes to something that you have argued for some time, that the Kiev National Guard, which is a volunteer force, has attracted the ultra-right of Ukraine. This is not a Ukrainian national army. This is a gang who seek to terrorize other Ukrainians and are attracting neo-Nazis from Europe to as mercenaries to also terrify Ukrainians. To what end, Steve? Why are neo-Nazis attracted to the National Guard?
Well, we need a little bit of historical background here. First is that Western Ukraine, which contains millions of extremely decent, fine people, nonetheless, historically, was the breeding ground of a kind of Ukrainian ultra-nationalism that produced movements that looked, smelled, and sounded fascist. They flew the equivalent of swastikas on their flag. They had good things to say about Hitler's occupation of Ukraine, about Ukrainian collaborators during World War II. They began to become part of political life when the protests broke out against former President Yanukovych back in February. When I wrote about that and said, you know, there are a lot of Democrats in the streets of Kiev calling for things that you and I would agree with, but there are also these street fighters who clearly are semi-fascist. I was widely denounced in this country. But now they have their own militia. Now, here's how that came about. The Ukrainian army had gone to rot since the end of the Soviet Union during those 20-some-odd years. So when Kiev had to mobilize an army, it didn't have to, but it decided to, rather than negotiate with the rebels in the southeast, but to go and defeat them as terrorists, as they call them. They didn't have much of an army, so they created what they call the National Guard. And in that National Guard, they invited all these street militia that had been around since February. In addition, there are 2 or 3 billionaire oligarchs in Ukraine whom Kiev has appointed governors of very large territories. They've created private militias. I mean, these guys have a lot of money. Militias with planes and tanks, and which has also attracted foreign mercenaries from other countries. Some people seem to think this is the Spanish Civil War being replayed. They just don't know their history. So what you have now fighting on what's the new Eastern Front, that is in Donbass, is the regular Ukrainian army, which, though they've been through 3 mobilizations and seem to have maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 or 50,000 troops, is not much of a fighting force. The regular Ukrainian army, and most of the soldiers speak Russian, they're not very keen about killing. They may even have relatives, a lot of them, by marriage in Donbass. They're not keen on hand-to-hand combat, close combat. So they are the ones who've been lobbing the artillery rockets into the cities from several kilometers away, or flying aircraft, or maybe in the tanks outside the checkpoints. But the militia, which are very ideological, ethnically extremist, even with ethnic cleansing on their time, and full of hatred for Russian-speaking Ukrainians in Russia, they are the ones who are doing the damage when they come into a civilian area. They plunder, they kill. They're doing things that are not acceptable even in the terms of war. The question is whether Kiev controls these militia, or whether the oligarchs control them, or whether they're operating independently and ideologically. So, for example, let us say the right thing is done and a ceasefire is declared tomorrow. How many of these militias, all or none or some, will cease firing? It's an open question. Kiev has lost control of those militia.
Let me give you some examples from the reporting from Eurasian Net about the Azov Battalion, which is named for its camp on the Sea of Azov, about 80 miles to the southwest of Luhansk. They first went into combat in June. These foreigners fighting with the Azov Battalion include 53-year-old Francesco F., who comes from Italy. He sits around the campfire singing hymns to Mussolini. There's another young man who's sitting next to him. He's 20 years old. He's a Swedish volunteer. His name is Severin. They just give him one name, Severin. He has a tattoo on his bicep saying "Son of Odin," and he boasts about his neo-Nazi roots. Their sniper, Swedish instructor, is a man who names himself Mikhail Skilt. He doesn't wear a mask. He doesn't hide himself. He comes from a Swedish party that is called Svenskarnas. That is a neo-Nazi party in Sweden, and he boasts about it. He actually says he has a bounty on his head from the separatists. Now, there's a lot of boasting going on here, so I can't confirm all of this. I do know that the Azov Battalion is in the field and that the Interior Ministry in Kiev acknowledges the Azov Battalion. It has its own symbol. So it's part of the offensive against the Donbass, and the separatists know it, Steve. They're aware of the fact that these cutthroats come from outside of Ukraine, and the Russians know it. That's why I'm reading it in English. They want the Russians to know this. This is part of the provocation, and I have to believe, Steve, when you said it's undisciplined, this is part of how social media works. This propaganda is meant to taunt Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin.
You see, that what you just described, and I think it's even worse than that, because there seem to be six or seven very large militia operating alongside or independently of the regular Ukrainian army. And by the way, it's those people that the residents of the Donbass really fear, because they are hateful and they wreak havoc on people and property and cities if they're able to enter these small cities outside the two large ones. But what's interesting is there have been a lot of complaints in the Western press from the White House, the State Department, that Russian mercenaries are fighting on the other side. I wouldn't call them mercenaries, but there probably are some. There's absolutely no question, though, we should be clear about this, that many Russians see what's going on in the Donbass as a moment of truth for Russia. Remember I mentioned to you when we spoke last week that Putin is being told this is no longer a struggle for Ukraine, this is a struggle for Russia. And among these people are young men in their 20s, who've never had a chance to fight, but have been in the Russian military and know how to operate weapons. But most interestingly, older men in their 40s and 50s, Russian fighters who were in Afghanistan or Chechnya, they see this, and they have a lot of their own publications, as a mission. They are on a mission to save Russia. So they are ideological, too. The difference is, I think, is that they have come to defend these cities. This may be unfair of me to formulate it this way. I've thought about it, and I've talked to friends of mine who live in Crimea who are very worried, and nearly every friend I know in Crimea has taken in refugees, put them up. The people who go from Russia, we see them as imperialists, as empire builders. They see themselves as saviors, coming to save two culturally Russian cities, where in all likelihood they have relatives. The militia on the other side, quasi-fascist, fascist, semi-fascist, just crazy, they've come to destroy, to capture, to occupy. And a theme that hasn't been reported but is emerging is the sense that some kind of ethnic cleansing is going on, that the property and the houses of the millions of refugees will be given to the members of these militia as a kind of bounty of war, a booty of war. It has become, civil war is the worst of wars, John. You know that.
Yes.
We had one. And it brings out both the best and the worst of people. And there are broken souls all over Europe and in Russia have decided this is their mission. I mean, I don't even want to mention the name, but one American magazine seems to have convinced itself this is the Spanish Civil War and is lending its intellectuals to this Kiev government and holding conferences and writing editorials about what a glorious moment this is in history. This is a complete misreading of the situation. This magazine will one day be embarrassed by what it's done. But I think we can say that Ukraine and the crisis hasn't brought out the best in anybody.
Steve, the Azov Battalion, I saw it reported in the New York Times, and I looked it up on EurasiaNet, but I've not seen it talked about or interviewed, or I've not seen American media go and verify these boasts by these men. Maybe they're just dreamed that they were neo-Nazis, but it certainly looks like they're cutthroats and criminals who've crossed into Ukraine and are lawless.
They're on the Internet, and unfortunately, I packed it away in a file. If I'd had it on my desk, I would cite it. But on the Internet, there are some very solid pieces of reporting, particularly by European correspondents who went there and talked to a number of these militia that are fighting for Kiev, that are quasi-fascist or extremist, and that include a sizable number of people from places like Sweden and other countries. It's well documented who and what these people are. Now, what Washington thinks about these people, my guess, Washington's worried. And my guess is that whoever's running this operation out of Washington, it's said to be Vice President Biden, that he's been tasked by Obama to handle the Ukrainian problem. No doubt they've told Poroshenko to try to get these militia under control, but he can't. He can't. Everybody's unleashed forces that they can no longer control, and by the way, there's a question here. We say, the United States, the solution is simple. Putin calls off his people in Ukraine, right, and it's over. But you remember, Putin asked them not to hold the referendum, and they went ahead. He's not the puppet master of these forces. These are indigenous forces. Is he helping them? Yes. Can he control them? Can he tell them tomorrow, give up your weapons, stop firing, don't defend your homes and your lands anymore? Absolutely not. And he can't do it for two reasons. One, he'd go down in infamy in Russian history. And secondly, they'd pay him no mind.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian history. And when we come back, Vladimir Putin, Steve mentions, is headed to Crimea for the meetings with the legislators there and taking with him the leadership of the Duma, the Russian State Duma. That is Thursday the 14th. Also, threats from the prime minister in Kiev about cutting off natural gas, not just flowing into Ukraine, but into Europe for the winter. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, New York University Russian History, as well as Princeton University. His book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. It's the Cold War we're looking at, and this confrontation in Ukraine is a global contest. There have been incidences documented these last days about Russian aircraft, warplanes seen off the coast of California or near the coast, the airspace of Alaska. Also, confrontations at sea between Russian warships and American warships. It's very much back to the future. This is the late 20th century before the end of the Cold War. Those kinds of games were played routinely between the forces, the Soviet forces and the American forces. Well, now it's the Russian Federation and the United States Navy, the United States Air Force. But it's not just the Cold War we worry about in America and Russia. It's also cold coming on to Europe. And Steve, I mentioned that the prime minister of Ukraine, Yatsenyuk, said very recently that he's looking at cutting, not only imposing sanctions on 172 Russians and 65 firms, but also banning Russian transit in Ukraine, including the transit of gas through the country. That's a direct threat to Germany and Europe. The question here is, Steve, will Europe take that? Will they accept the fact that Ukraine has the power to turn off its natural gas for winter?
When I read his announcement that he was proposing that, now I'm not sure, because it was taking the form of a parliamentary resolution, that the Ukrainian parliament passed it. But he is the prime minister. And in some ways, he's more powerful than the president, Poroshenko, because they reverted, after the coup against Yanukovych, to a prior constitution which gave the parliament more power than the president. But what was the motive of Yatsenyuk, the prime minister, saying that he might ban the transit of Russian natural gas to Europe? I mean, you would think that he's harming the only people who keep him in power, the European countries and Washington. Maybe his message was, end this with Russia, come on in. NATO should come in and end this. so we can
That's what they want.
That's what they want. But it is wickedly reckless and crazy. About the Crimean thing, which is related, let's remind your listeners that Russia annexed, or as it was said in the legislation, reunited with Crimea back in March. What Putin is doing, I think, the day after tomorrow.
Thursday the 14th. He's traveling to several cities in Crimea.
So if anybody decides to watch this on their computer, remember it's 8 hours later there. So you need to tune in a little early. It's extremely interesting, but a little mysterious. I mean, one thing is clear. Putin is taking virtually the entire Russian political government to Crimea. They're all going to fly in. And they're going to hold a big session there. All right, what is he doing? He is saying symbolically, Crimea is now and forever what it always has been, except by accident for 20 years or so, part of Russia. Why is he doing this? Because the Kiev government says almost daily that we look forward to a victory parade in Crimea. In other words, after Donbass, we intend to march on to Crimea. And that is why, in return, Putin is now being told it's no longer a struggle for Ukraine, it's a struggle for Russia. Fight today in Donbass or fight tomorrow in Crimea. The further problem is, though, is that the State Department, our State Department, has made this a talking point, that Crimea must be returned as part of any settlement to Ukraine. The State Department doesn't mean that. They know that's not possible short of war. But the fact that they would back Kiev on this, so Putin is now going to answer. If he takes virtually himself and the Russian government, and by the way, they all have other things to do. Russia has a lot of problems. To Crimea, he is basically saying, symbolically, this is Russia's second capital. It's like St. Petersburg. That's what he's saying. That's how important Crimea is. Now, what more? What more? I mean, he's saying, don't you even dare think about it. What more? A couple of my friends in Moscow who have their opinions and follow the news think he's going to draw a military ultimatum the day after tomorrow in Crimea. He is going to announce a deadline that if this doesn't stop, and they have been forewarned, he will enter Ukraine with troops or air power around the Donbass. I have no reason to think that's so, but these two guys I talked to are right about 75% of the time in what they write to me. So it could be it's going to be the scene of a very, very important announcement.
The convoy entering Ukraine at the same time
is accidentally
well-timed.
Yeah, and I meant to go on to say that my friends in Moscow pointed out to me that they did the logging of the trip and the time when Putin, that if there's any trouble with that convoy as being attacked or entering Ukraine, that Putin will issue some kind of ultimatum. But even if he doesn't, the symbolism of taking, I mean, imagine in this country, I don't know, Texas was threatened and Obama flew the whole Congress and administration out to Texas. I mean, it is very unusual, I can't think, except in wartime when the capital was in danger, Moscow, when something like this has happened. It's a very dramatic moment.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, the book to pay attention to, because we're moving into the Cold War games of the 20th century, is Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War. Steve also has a piece up at thenation.com right now reviewing the events of these last months, especially those who have doubted that neo-Nazis are part of the Kiev National Guard attacking Donbass, waiting for the convoy to reach the Ukraine border. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show.